Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Killett, your host. So happy to be back with you on a Monday afternoon. It's always just great. The hours just drag till we get to come back on the air, and it's nice to be back on the air. Thanks for being here with us. That means a lot that you take the time to be with us. And I believe that effort, if you put any effort into it, I don't know, will be rewarded today. Second hour, Father Matthew Spencer will be here, and we just love Father Matthew Spencer. He's the head of the Oblates of St. Joseph here in the United States. We're going to do Ask a Priest with him. This hour, Pat Flynn from Philosophy for the People is our guest. Pat's the author of five children and books. I was five books, but now also five children. I don't know if you can say author of, but I guess not. No.
Co-author derivative secondary sense, right?
Yeah. There's a philosopher for you. But you probably know him most either from helping you with your kettlebell workouts or Philosophy for the People. Pat Flynn, thanks for being with us.
Cy, it has been too long. It is a pleasure to be back.
I do not recognize you. I have never seen you before. What is this about? What has happened
to you? I live in Wisconsin now, if people don't know. We've made the move to cold Wisconsin, so I'm trying to conform myself to the culture out here.
Uh-huh.
And hence this mangy animal on my face. Bratwurst, a lot of charred fatty meat.
Nice.
And you know, some flannel and some beard, as best as I can. Yeah.
Did you say beard?
The beast.
With a D?
The beast, beard, yeah, oh. Beard. Milwaukee's Best, The Beast is a popular selection out here. So Wisconsin culture, it's a very unique thing, and I recommend people check it out. It's a fun place to be.
It is. Wisconsin is a quite unique place. That's very interesting. So that and Wisconsin convinced you to grow a Moses-like beard. So the very wise Pat Flynn is our guest this hour. If you want to talk with Pat, 888-318-7884. What we're going to talk about is arguments for God, and that is a fun way to start off the week. 888-318-7884. Are you finding yourself at a deficit of arguments for God? Maybe there's someone who's asking you, like, why do you believe in God? And you'd like a little help explaining that. Maybe it's your own thing. Maybe you don't believe in God, and you think of us as delusional or odd or otherwise wrong for believing in God. Whoever you are, whatever is the case, if you want to talk about arguments for God, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. And one of the arguments for God that I think I learned from you, Pat, is the argument that there's a lot of arguments for God. Do you know what I'm...
the argument from so many arguments, we call that.
Is that what you call that, really? Because it's actually...
It's not, I didn't invent it. Other people have
It's actually
that,
quite convincing to me. I thought, well, there's one way, one strategy of because I actually think the truth is a lot of times people say, why do you believe in God? I end up kind of, you know, doing my Christian testimony kind of when they say
sure.
that. But I also was so happy when you gave me that argument from the argument from a lot of arguments, because in a certain way, I just want to say, well, the evidence is everywhere. That's why I believe in God.
Yeah. Well, I think this would be a good opportunity to explain different philosophical approaches to God, unless, you know, we're ready to hop right to callers.
No, but go ahead.
So, you know, in traditional or perennial philosophy, especially Aquinas, you often have what are called these metaphysical demonstrations or proofs, and they start in what's called philosophy of nature or metaphysics, or just trying to carve reality at its joints and make sense of various experiences, like what is change or how do things endure over time? And they come up with all these metaphysical principles. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, they think that to sort of make sense of the whole system, to make sense of why anything changes or how there's identity through change or how there's composite things, whatever. There's a lot of different, I think, avenues to God. They're going to say the necessary condition to make sense of all of that is a being that sort of is radically distinct from all those things that require an extrinsic explanation. Right. So all changing things ultimately have to be cashed out by something that's fundamentally unchanging. All composite or complex things have to be cashed out in something that's ultimately absolutely simple, right, or non-composite. And Aquinas and many others then go on to say when you kind of run a conceptual analysis on what an entity like that is, it turns out to have these traditional divine attributes, right? We can get into that later if we want. That is a hard apologetic project to get across.
Yeah.
I mean, even what I just explained in summary format is pretty complicated, right? You have to roll up your sleeves, you have to do a lot of metaphysics. Most people probably think you're talking about anamnesis, if you even bring up that word, right? So it's not the best apologetic. I think it's really interesting, and I think at the end of the day, a lot of those arguments are sound. But I think a better sort of everyday approach is say, hey, I've got a lot of different reasons for why I believe in God. I think just as a sort of fundamental explanation, God makes sense of a very wide range of experience. God helps make sense of why there's any contingent things at all, things that are but don't have to be. God helps to make sense of why there's any conscious beings, why there's any beings capable of rationality, why there's religious experience, why there are near-death experiences, the laws of logic, the uncanny applicability of mathematics, the historical data surrounding the rise of Christianity. I mean, the list goes on and on. I actually think God explains a lot of stuff that stands in need of an explanation. I also think God is a sort of relatively simple hypothesis, and people tend to like that. If they're of a scientific mind, you kind of like a simple hypothesis. And if you're thinking of fundamental theories, well, in terms of a fundamental theory, it's just one entity that's absolutely ontologically simple. So it seems like it has a lot going for it. So it tends to explain a lot with very little. And I think that's virtuous in terms of theory selection. And if you just kind of like introduce that to people, they might pick at it. Like, tell me more about how you think God explains this thing or that thing or the other thing. And then it can kind of invite conversation to go in whatever direction might be of interest to the person at that moment. And I found that approach is often helpful and more accessible at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Are you okay? You safe from that train?
Yeah, there's a train that lives behind my house, and I'm a little nervous these days.
Or does a horn go off when you finish your answer? Yeah, is that just how
just
it is in your house?
Jump out of my seat, right? Yeah.
888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. This is exactly what I'm talking about, Pat. This is why I find your philosophy for the people and your general approach so helpful. In that, I do think that Aquinas, for example, is quite convincing when I have tried to, you know, use my little mind to grasp what his big mind is putting down. But right. I don't have any confidence that I could ever use that successfully in apologetics or evangelization or in any other practical way. I mean, unless it was the most good-willed person in the world listening to me and maybe even helping along, I'm not going to convince anybody using Aquinas' five proofs.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe you could get off a summary of like the third way or something like that. But I think rather the way to position it, and this is just for some general advice as apologetics, you mentioned your testimony, so I think that's good. I kind of have a philosophical testimony. You know, I was a naturalist, an atheist for many years, and I just started to have problems with that world. I realized that I don't think the explanations that are given for various things that I think need to be explained are ultimately any good. And there are all these philosophical puzzles and problems I was struggling with. And it led me to consider certain schools of philosophy, at least in a deeper sense. You know, I was vaguely familiar with a lot of these thinkers in a superficial way. But to go back and say, okay, what did Aristotle really think? You know, let me try and really wrestle with him. And then, you know, you get up to St. Thomas Aquinas and Thomistic thinkers. And I realized they give you a picture of reality that is very systematic. Whatever else you want to say about Aquinas, I mean, he connects everything, right? He connects his theory of being to ethics, to aesthetics,
yeah, right?
Right. And it's all very practical and it's all very beautiful. So I think that's another like point in its favor. Like you have this coherence in this worldview, things sort of hang together, everything links up really nicely. Now maybe it links up really nicely and it's all false, right? But just the fact that it links up really nicely was something that attracted me. I liked that how Aquinas thinks about fundamental issues of existence has something to say about how we should behave ethically. Like that's nice. Whereas if you look at a lot of modern philosophy, it's a lot of the projects are very piecemeal, kind of pieces are just kind of pasted together arbitrarily. It doesn't seem like one piece really hangs together nicely with another piece, or one area of philosophy informs another area of philosophy. It becomes very disjointed. Aquinas' approach is not disjointed. And I'll just kind of explain that to people, what attracted me about the Thomistic system, and then let the conversation naturally evolve. If they want to go a little bit deeper, I'll try and give a little bit more. But I think you're definitely right, Si, that if you just try to like ram through, I don't know, an argument for motion and try bring out the act potency distinction and the principle of proportionate causality and all that, it's going to be a train wreck as I look over my shoulder. Right? Yeah.
Oh, we're praying for no train wreck during this hour. Pat Flynn is our guest coming to us from Wisconsin now. Philosophy for the People. You should check it out. Making a difficult thought easy and even fun. That's their goal over there, and they do a great job of it. If you want to talk with Pat, you can call right now, right here, 888-318-7884. By the way, if you don't agree with us, if you think, theism or this belief in God is a relic or is not logically supportable, we'd love to talk with you as well. You're very welcome here, 888-318-7884. I have to take the first break, so a couple callers on. I just ask you to wait through this break, and then we'll get you on with Pat Flynn right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. This hour, our guest is Pat Flynn from Philosophy for the People, philosophyforthepeople.com. If you'd like to talk with Pat about arguments for God, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I do want to, before I go to those callers, I do have to let you know about the School of Apologetics spring enrollment drive. All of our courses are 50 to 65% off, and they really will help you grow as an apologist. Whether you're explaining the faith to the kids or to the parents or to anybody else, these courses will be very helpful. Instructors like Jimmy Akin, Carlo Broussard, Trent Horn, Steve Weidenkopf, Tim Staples, Chris Check. You know you're getting good stuff. Just go over to shop.catholic.com to get started and get yourself 50 to 65% off the courses in the School of Apologetics right now. That's shop.catholic.com. Pat Flynn, our guest, does philosophy all the time on the internets, as Pat was mentioning. Not always a believer himself. What would you say you were, a naturalist or a materialist, or how would you call it?
That's right. So my introduction to philosophy in high school was really through the old atheists and existentialists, and that pulled me into a naturalistic worldview for some time. Now, naturalism is a very loose term, but mine was, I would say, towards a materialist, physicalist type of perspective. And then, I came out of that. And then I kind of floated around as a general agnostic, came to belief in God and classical theism, and then actually spent a fair amount of time in the camp of religious pluralism side, where I was kind of attracted to various thoughts in Hinduism. I actually have a very close friend that is a Hindu, so it was interesting to explore books like Aldous Huxley's Perennial Philosophy, you know, where they kind of say, like, hey, all religion is true and false in a sense, right? It's true that all religions are kind of groping towards something transcendent, but they're all false in their specific claims, right? So just pick whatever one does it for you. And what moved me out of that was just coming to consider the real historical credentials of Christianity, and I think the explanatory power actually of the Catholic Church as well.
It's an amazing story, but certainly not a unique story, Pat. Many people have
told a million times.
Because the truth is beautiful and it's attractive, and we have the beautiful and attractive Pat Flynn here to prove it. Just check out his beard and you will agree with me. 888-318-7884. All right, Pat's in Wisconsin, he said, and now Aaron's in Wisconsin as well, listening on Catholic.com, so it'll be all Wisconsin show for a minute here. Aaron, go ahead with your question for Pat.
Hey guys, first time caller here. Just wanted to get your take on like a two-part question. Do you think that atheism leads to nihilism? And do you think that, or why do you think so many Christians seem to be falling into nihilism today?
Okay, good question. Well, we should introduce the concept of nihilism. And generally nihilism refers to the denial that there's any sort of objective moral value or meaning or purpose to the world. And by objective, we mean it's like attitude or stance independent, that things really are valuable or good or meaningful, regardless of how I feel about them, right? So the nihilist would say there's none of that stuff. Right. That anything that we think is valuable, it's only valuable, well, because we think it's valuable. Things are good. They have their goodness just because we desire them. If we stop desiring them, they wouldn't be really good or something like that. Right. And then there's also not just moral value. There's also moral duties and obligations. We think that even if I don't feel like doing something, I have an obligation to do something in certain situations or even refrain from doing something in other situations. A nihilist would deny there's any such thing as objective, universally binding moral obligations either. Now, the question is, does atheism lead to nihilism? And it's funny. So you asked me at the beginning of the show of reasons I believe in God. And one thing I didn't mention is I think our moral experience is another kind of data point that needs to be explained. Like, we do tend to speak and act as if things really are inherently valuable and that we really are under certain moral obligations and stuff like that. And I think that's something that needs an account. Now, can atheism account for it? Well, I think it's worth noting that many atheists, naturalists specifically, historically and today, are nihilists. And the reason they're nihilists is that it seems like something like a nihilistic picture sort of flows from the grand story of atheistic naturalism. The grand story is something like this, right? You have the beginning of the universe, whatever that was, whether the universe is eternal or began at the Big Bang or a multiverse or something like that. And then you have atomic theory and evolutionary theory and just recombination of material bits. And eventually you get us after the primordial soup and evolutionary forces and stuff like that. And pretty much everything about us is shaped by such evolutionary forces, right? The kind of fight for survival, including our beliefs. And that would seem to also include our moral beliefs. So it seems like for the atheist, a very simple way of trying to explain our moral beliefs and behaviors is in terms of pure utility or survival value. And that's it, right? That it doesn't link up to anything beyond ourselves, that we sort of form these false but useful beliefs because they were just useful in avoiding bears and getting dates or something like that, right? And it kind of is parallel to the way that many atheists or naturalists think about belief in God. I mean, you often hear this, right? Well, the whole God delusion, there's a book called that, right, is literally a delusion because it's just a false belief that we developed from wherever, but it was useful for survival. And so evolution kind of kept it around and spread it around and all that sort of stuff. So many atheists think that you can give this type of explanation of morality, which is important. It's not really explaining our moral experience. It's explaining it away, right? It's explaining it away. It's not what it seems to be, you might say, right? And that seems like a pretty nice, lean hypothesis and theory. It's got a lot going for it, except for that it's false. I mean, clearly some things are objectively wrong. Raping and torturing small children is a moral evil. It's a horror. It has nothing to do with anybody's preference. In fact, if you prefer doing that, we think that that is extremely morally objectionable, that there's something seriously wrong with you, right? So I think taking a nihilistic perspective on morality leads to such a sort of repugnant reduction to the absurd that it should cause you to go back and question whatever starting point led you to that conclusion. Now, for the sake of fairness and completeness, not all naturalists are moral nihilists, right? Or not all of them are moral error theorists is another way of explaining it. Some of them do try to make sense of objective morality. How could you have a sort of objective moral framework without God in the picture? And there's some, you know, there's some clever accounts out there. Some try to kind of go back to Plato and say, hey, maybe we could borrow like Plato's realm of forms and have these kind of abstract objects help us ground moral facts and moral obligations and park it in reason and stuff like that. Those accounts are very complex. I'll just say at the end of the day, I don't think that they ultimately work, or to the extent that they do work, it's such an enormously convoluted, ad hoc, and complicated theory that itself is, I think, a pretty decisive strike against it. You're pulling in things into a naturalistic worldview that otherwise don't belong there or can't be made sense of on a naturalistic worldview, if that makes sense. So I think for naturalists to try and avoid the absurd moral consequence of nihilism, what they have to do is they have to complicate their naturalistic theory in ways that it makes naturalism either no longer believable or no longer interesting as an explanatory theory. So that would be my general way of approaching whether naturalism entails nihilism. I guess I wouldn't say that it entails, it's inescapable, but to the extent that you kind of avoid the logic of naturalism moving towards nihilism, you have to kind of make naturalism a pretty fantastic and somewhat unbelievable thing. Because, and one more point, it's not just moral facts and obligations that we have to make sense of, it's also moral knowledge. How do we come to know of various moral truths? And naturalism has to explain that as well. And that's another very difficult thing to explain from a naturalistic standpoint, especially if you start positing a realm of abstract objects and that we somehow link up with it just through blind evolutionary forces. It starts to sound pretty magical, I think, at the end of the day. So I don't know, how's that? Does that make any sense, Cy and Aaron, as a start, as a little opening gambit?
Oh, it does.
And sorry, you had one other question there?
Yeah, do you think it's true? And if it is true, how do you think it's happening? That it just seems like some Christians are falling into nihilism, whether consciously or unconsciously, these days. It just seems like that's happening.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. I think it's correct in a sense. I would just want to kind of make a distinction between different types of nihilism. So there's the nihilism of the intellectual nihilism, where you look at a worldview and or various moral theories, and you just deny on a sort of meta-ethical level that there are any moral facts or obligations like that. But then there's a practical nihilism, right? There's a lived nihilism, where you kind of live your life as if there's not really any greater meaning, value, or purpose. Some people call this a sort of technological nihilism as well, that we're so sort of wrapped up in the consumerism of our day, that we're so distracted and plugged in to various things, Netflix, the internet, social media, that nihilism might as well be true, given how so many of us live. And I think, certainly many people have fallen into that. I think it's a serious snare. I think it's a serious spiritual snare. Kind of affirming what you say, I think it's a right observation. And even if it's not an intellectual nihilism, because I'm sure many of those people living in that sort of mode would deny an outright nihilism, it seems to me that it is a more or less practical or lived type of nihilism, if that makes sense.
Aaron, phones are filling up, so I'm going to leave it there. I hope that was helpful to you. They were wonderful questions. I'm very grateful for them. We're talking about arguments for God. Our guest is Pat Flynn from philosophyforthepeople.com. The number's 888-318-7884. And Pat in New York City, New York City, watching on Facebook is next. Hi, Pat.
Hello. So Hi, Pat. My question is regarding the connection between intelligent design and the argument for God, and whether the two support each other, interfere with each other, they're just irrelevant to each other, or whether we need to keep them at a distance.
Yeah, great question, Pat, and great name. So intelligent design, it's really a community. It's a camp of different thinkers who have different arguments. It's not a school that I've spent a huge amount of time in. The one I'm most familiar with would be the account of Dr. Michael Behe, who originally authored Darwin's Black Box and Edge of Evolution, and most recently Darwin Devolves. And your question was, what is the relevance of intelligent design for the existence of God and against evolutionary theory? So, let's analyze this. This is a good question. So, first off, most proponents of intelligent design are not arguing specifically for God. They're arguing that something in nature, say the bacteria flagellum or various other molecular machines, if you're Michael Behe, exhibit a sort of complexity, an irreducible complexity, that cannot be adequately accounted for by unguided evolutionary forces. Unguided is the key word, right? So we need some sort of intelligent agency that can account for the purposeful arrangement of parts and stuff like that to give an actual adequate explanation of this. Now, I'm not endorsing any of these arguments right now. I'm just trying to report them. However, Behe and other people will say even though they are arguing for an intelligent designer, that's not necessarily an argument for God. Now, as it happens, most of them do believe in God. Many of them are Christians, but they're willing to entertain for the sake of neutrality, I suppose. Hey, maybe it was aliens. Maybe it's a committee of gods. You know, if you have a committee of gods, maybe that explains the camel. I mean, how else do you look at that thing and think that wasn't the work of a committee or something like that? So they're kind of neutral on you know, moving from an intelligent designer to the god of Christianity or classical theism or something like that. They're mostly just interested in arguing against naturalistic evolutionary theory as being explanatorily adequate. Now, where I think it is relevant, if you pursue this line of argument, comes from a line from a philosopher named Alvin Plantinga. He actually, in one of his books, Where the Conflict Really Lies, I hear the music coming, so why don't I pause right there and we'll pick it up on the
all
other
right.
side, if that's right.
Pat in New York, I hope you can hang on. Pat in Wisconsin will continue his answer right after this. Catholic Answers Live, 888-318-7884. Talking arguments for God this hour with Pat Flynn. More of that right after this.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Difficult Discussions.
Are challenging conversations wearing you down? We'll help you navigate conflict gracefully.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Our good friend Pat Flynn is in Wisconsin. He's one of the two proprietors of Philosophy for the People, and you should check it out, making hard thinking easy and fun and all that. And Pat in New York City is a good friend of Catholic Answers and also very helpful on our social media a good part of the time. And Pat in New York City asks about intelligent design and its relationship to belief in God, if there is anything. Pat Flynn was in the midst of an answer, and you may continue now, Pat Flynn.
Yes. So I was trying to outline just the general sketch of at least one thinker in the intelligent design community, and that's Dr. Michael Behe. And I was getting on to where this might be relevant in the wider debate between, say, theism and naturalism. And I brought up Alvin Plantinga. He's got a really nice book called Where the Conflict Really Lies. And he's looking at whether there's a conflict between science and religion. And ultimately, he's saying the real conflict substantially is actually between science and naturalism. But one point he brings out in that book is that for the naturalist, sort of evolution is the only game in town. Like, this better work as an explanation, or naturalism loses a lot of explanatory gas. So where intelligent design arguments become relevant is if they're good arguments, and we could talk about whether I think they are or not, if we want to do a follow-up question, is they would take a lot of steam out of this theory that's doing a ton of explanatory work for the naturalist, right? And if this is the only game in town that the naturalist has, that's bad news for them in the kind of grand scheme of things in terms of comparing paradigms, fundamental theories of everything. Because for the theist, and this is something Alvin Plantinga points out, is that the theist can sort of be neutral to evolution, right? You know, if God wanted to bring about life through Darwinian processes, no big deal. If he wanted to do it some other way, that's fine too. So evolution, I think properly understood, is certainly not a threat to a theistic worldview. But for the naturalist, it's the sort of thing, well, this better be able to give us the sort of explanations we need, because if this doesn't work, we might be out of luck in terms of explaining a lot of things that need to be explained. And in that sense, intelligent design is kind of going right for the heart of the matter, that if their arguments are good, it's and I think that's probably why people in intelligent design have gotten a lot of heat thrown at them. I will say that, you know, I think they've been treated a bit unfairly. In few other circles do you see people really dragged through the mud, even by people who should, you know, be a bit more respectful of other people. I mean, you see professional philosophers saying really awful, slanderous things about people like Dr. Michael Behe, who is a man trying to make an honest argument and is backing it up with what he argues is the best of our contemporary scientific knowledge on the matter. And he's frequently dismissed via personal attacks, call, you know, attributed beliefs to him that he actually does not believe. And I think why is that? I've always wondered, why is that happening? Well, I think that a lot of naturalists might realize that his project is a real threat to their entire paradigm. And it's a threat in a way that is very accessible for people to grasp. So unlike Aquinas' metaphysical, you know, arguments, which I think are a threat to naturalism, they're hard to grasp. They're not really intuitive or accessible. But an argument from irreducible complexity, when you bring out the bacteria flagellum and show all the different coordination and how the everything has to be arranged just so and shaped just so before you get any functional utility whatsoever, it presents a really vivid initial and strong case against the naturalistic theory of evolution as being explanatory and adequate. And I think people kind of get that in their gut, and it's stuck with a lot of people. And I think that's, you know, generated some unhelpful emotional responses from people who should be a bit more professional in the way they respond to other thinkers. But that's, of course, just armchair speculation at this point.
Pat, in New York, what do you think?
Yeah, that's an excellent summary. I think the way I summarize it to the people who ask about an RCA is the argument for God ultimately is a philosophical one, and we take that, you know, we can take that very personally. But the intelligent design proponents are saying, we're running experiments and we're looking at things under microscopes, and there's more there's less philosophy and more science in intelligent design. And I completely agree with Pat that this is a real threat to the, you know, the established order.
Yeah, if you just want my opinion on it, I think that's right. I think there are certain arguments. I wouldn't endorse the whole community because I haven't read all of the work, but in the work that I have read and studied and looked at the counter arguments and differing positions, I would say Michael Behe's is something that deserves attention. It deserves to be taken seriously. That's what I'll say about that.
Mm-hmm. Pat, thanks for the call. For Pat,
thank you, Pat.
My lines are pretty full, so I'm going to keep moving. But thank you again. Let's go to Ivy in South Carolina, listening on 106.7 FM. Ivy, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Pat Flynn.
Hey, so my question was, I tuned in around the time you were talking about thinking that God is a very almost Occam's razor answer to a lot of questions, which I would agree with. But I do wonder why you would say specifically the Christian God, the Abrahamic God, and not any other alternative God.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a question I ask myself as well, because as I don't know if you heard this part, Ivy, but for many years I parked out in religious pluralism, so I wasn't committed to any God of associated with a religion that claims to have special revelation or something like that. So I thought there was some transcendent principle, you know, broadly in line with traditional theism, but I wasn't committed to Catholicism like I am now. And there's a couple of different ways to approach this, but I'll explain how I approached it. First is just I think there is a strongly credible case to be made for Christianity, from historical research to try and explain how did these beliefs originally arise, arguments from the reliability of the Gospels. I have good friends who are specialists who focus on this type of research, and making a sort of cumulative case based around this historical data that the best explanation for it is just the traditional Christian explanation, that the incarnation really occurred, the resurrection really happened, and that Christianity is true. But that isn't the only thing that moved me. It was sort of a wider – I'll try and zoom out as much as I can. It was sort of a wider array of many different converging considerations. A lot of it was philosophical. So I think you can make various arguments for God that specify classical theism, a God that is absolutely transcendent, completely simple, whose essence is its existence, and is ultimately goodness itself, right? And then you can go look at the world, and I think you can deduce very quickly that something's sort of gone wrong with this world, right? That we've sort of fallen away from God, something broken about this world. Even the pagans really kind of had this notion of something being wrong in a vague sense that's familiar of original sin, right? And then you can ask, well, given that that's happened, what's the likelihood that God would try to correct that, right? That God would try to do something about that, right? What is the likelihood that God would try to return us to himself in some way, or to restore the proper order of the universe, or what have you, right? And I think once you kind of have a prior commitment of God, a philosophical commitment of God, and you just look at the world and realize that it is, there's something fundamentally screwy about it, something like the incarnation and resurrection starts to make a lot of sense, right? And it makes sense in a very philosophically interesting way, that it's not just that God just sort of, you know, snapped his metaphorical fingers and just righted everything by way of miracle, but he entered into creation to bring us back into union with himself by literally uniting himself or pulling a human nature, right, to the second person of the Trinity. And if we think that our, you know, ultimate end is union with God, this is a really kind of remarkable, beautiful way to achieve this union with God, right? For God to kind of enter in to this broken history, into our story. There was something of a deep existential resonance about the Christian story in particular that I thought was really befitting. Aquinas talks of befitting arguments a lot, that this is really befitting of the nature and goodness of God, that itself is a sort of hint, not a proof, but a hint that we have a credible story on our hands. So I think kind of wider philosophical outlooks like that, a look at the historical data surrounding the resurrection, and then also, you know, being more specific about Catholicism. I think Catholicism makes certain predictions, and I think it makes pretty much all accurate predictions. You know, Catholicism has certain doctrine about God. I think its doctrine about God are just the sorts of things that good philosophical reasoning reveals about God. So the church seems to get something right there. I think actually in its ethical teaching kind of aligns with good philosophical natural law reasoning as well. I think the church predicts her own endurance. The church has certainly endured. The church predicts her own indefectibility. The church has, I would argue, it, when you really look into it, has been indefectible. So it's a sort of, again, Cy, we talk about kind of like the argument from so many arguments. It's a cumulative converging case where after I made a philosophical shift to classical theism, it shined a certain light or gave me a certain expectation that made something like the incarnation and atonement really befitting, made good philosophical sense. It was really beautiful. It seemed like there was good historical evidence there, certainly when it with how it plays with the background philosophical considerations, and then further credibility just from the historical record of the Catholic Church. All that is what pushed me in the direction of where I am now. Is that helpful at all?
Yeah, it definitely is.
Well, Ivy, I'm going to say thanks because I got to take a break, and I still got lots and lots of folks on the line for Pat. But another great question. I've really enjoyed all the questions this hour. More questions to come for Pat on arguments for God right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, "Why don't you air these people?" And I said, "No, because I don't think they're Catholic." He says, "By what right do you have to say that?" I said, "I own the network."
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Pat Flynn, our guest. He's got a squeaky chair. He's got a train in his backyard. But he's a very fine... Pat, could you manage the noise at some point?
I'm so noisy. I know. At least I got my kids out of the house. I did you that favor. Yeah, I prefer the kids to the squeaky chair.
Yeah.
Train horse.
We're talking about arguments for God. Up next is David in Peoria, Illinois, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. First of all, David, thank you for downloading our app onto your phone. And go ahead with your question for Pat.
Hello, David.
Hello, Pat. Thank you so much. I have a friend who is somewhere between atheism and agnosticism. We've been having some philosophical discussions, but we're both beginners. Just went on your site, downloaded the free ebook, and bookmarked the site.
Oh,
so thanks for that.
Thank you.
I was looking
for
further resources for introducing us to like Aristotelian thought and things like that, because we can't really get into Aquinas until doing that. And I struggle with it myself, so
yes,
it'd be nice
yes.
if we had some resources.
Of course. Well, here's a proof of God, and that's his obvious providence. Right here, I have a wonderful volume. It's called The One and the Many by Father Norris Clark, a contemporary Thomistic metaphysics. This is something I frequently recommend for people who want a very accessible, beautifully written introduction to the philosophical Thomism, which, of course, is an extension of not just Aristotelianism, but Platonic thought as well. You know, Aquinas was a great synthesizer. So I would definitely recommend that one. But if you wouldn't mind, if you want to just tell me about the sorts of conversations that you're having with your friend, maybe I could give some other more specific recommendations as well.
Currently, we've been at first he was kind of on the side of naturalism, and all we can know is naturalism, and so the only truths we can attain are through science. And so we've been having a lot of conversations about that. He's been able to recognize that, oh, we can't get all truths through science, you know, including like, hey, prove that science is a good. You seem to think it's really good. Prove it with science, you know, that old thing.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Hey, it's an old thing, but it's a good thing.
On that. Yep, yeah, it's an old thing, but it's a good thing, and it's very easily recognizable if someone gets it.
Right, yeah, that science assumes a lot, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, keep going, sorry.
Yeah, and then we were having some discussions over, you know, like first causes, second causes, things like that, but once we start getting into, like, substances and essences, I lose them, and I can barely even grasp it always myself, so that's
right,
why I was
right.
thinking
well, that...
some introductory stuff to Aristotelian stuff would get us a little further.
Yeah, well, I think Norris Clark's volume right there is a really great starting point. It's just what we were talking about before, Cy, is just the sort of general inaccessibility once you start getting into the deeper metaphysics. But when you have, you know, good, honest people who are really trying to inquire together, which it seems like is the case here, that's when you can do that stuff, and it becomes really productive. So it is good to have resources. So yeah, I would not only just recommend this book here, The One and the Many. Philosopher Ed Fazer has a nice introduction too. It's called Scholastic Metaphysics, and I found I really enjoyed that book. So between these two, and the nice thing about One and the Many is you'll not only, you know, be introduced to hylomorphism and Aquinas' theory of causality and grounding and all that. He actually does cover a bit of natural theology in this book, so you'll see how he applies it in a broad contingency argument for the existence of God as well. So, yeah, that's quite providential because it was just lying right here. So I'd go snag that one.
Sweet.
Is that helpful,
Thank
David?
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you,
Yeah,
David.
That's helpful,
sure.
Especially since we're working with natural natural theology and things like that, since he could really grasp into the natural stuff, obviously. That'll be helpful. Thank you very much. And it's much more accessible than like Swinburne and stuff like that.
One quick comment about that, because Swinburne is, this is exactly the difference between the two approaches I talked about earlier, Cy. So, you know, Norris Clark, he's following Thomas, where he thinks that if you just carve reality at its joints and you get the proper categories that you need to make sense of various experiences, God's just going to follow inevitably, right, by a certain train of logic. Now, it takes a lot of kind of upfront, hard metaphysical work to get to the existence of God. God's kind of the climax of this great metaphysical inquiry, if you will. Swinburne's different. Richard Swinburne, and you're probably talking about his book, The Existence of God. Although I will say, if you're into Swinburne, he's got a more accessible book, Is There a God? So if you're looking for like more accessible Swinburne, that might be a place to start. But he's treating God as an upfront theoretical worldview hypothesis, right? He's saying, let's form a hypothesis and let's call it God, and let's say that God has these sorts of properties, right? And let's compare it to a naturalistic hypothesis. And he's going to argue that it's a simpler hypothesis, at least in the relevant respects, and it explains more of the data that a worldview needs to explain. And I forget all the things in his book, but I think he goes through contingency, fine-tuning, moral experience, takes on suffering and evil as well. And yeah, so his is kind of an argument from so many arguments. It's a cumulative case, inference to the best explanation type of approach. And that approach at the end of the day, because it's sort of scientific in its mode of reasoning, will give you a credence in a hypothesis. It will give you a sort of confidence. And Swinburne's going to say it should give you a very high confidence in God's existence. But the traditional approach, the metaphysical approach, is saying, no, it's going to follow with certainty from certain commitments that not only that God exists, but God has certain properties necessarily. So you're not kind of like forming in the abstract some God hypothesis and saying, this is what I think omnipotence is, and this is what I think omniscience is, because down the line you might run into various paradoxes or troubles with those conceptions. Rather, you're going effect back to primary cause and then running a conceptual analysis on what an absolutely simple, purely actual being is. And then you get an understanding of a restricted understanding, I think a more accurate understanding of things like omnipotence and omniscience and perfect goodness that way. So the traditional approach, I think, has the advantage of giving you more confidence, a potential certainty in the existence of God, but also gives you, I think, a better conception of the divine nature as far as we can grasp it. Of course, Aquinas would say we can't comprehend the divine nature, but we can say true things about God, that he is absolutely simple. We can talk about God's omnipotence, not in the sense that God can just do anything, but in terms of what's producible. Aquinas thinks of omnipotence in terms of producibility. God can produce anything that it is is logically possible to produce and stuff like that. And I think the advantage there is, although you have to do more work up front, I think you get more payoff and more security downstream. Whereas Swinburne is, you might not have to do as much work up front, but you have more troubles and difficulties downstream. So none of it's easy. You're going to have your work cut out for you no matter which way you go. And I actually think these methods can play well together. And this is actually the focus of my upcoming book that I have, hopefully due out this summer, is that I think you can form your hypothesis and really demonstrate God's existence with the traditional approach. But then you can use a Swinburne type of methodology to then go and show how explanatorily fruitful it is as well, to get additional confirmation if you think that's neat as well, with a tighter conception of God, with the hypothesis being formed from the prior metaphysical approach. Sorry, I just unloaded a ton. I didn't mean to. I kind of went into a spasm. Forgive me. I hope it
intellectual
was somewhat
spasm.
Helpful.
Yeah. All right, David. I'm going to leave it there because there are a couple more folks who would like to talk to our guest, Pat Flynn, before he goes. But thank you for that call, David. Johnny's in Warren, Michigan, listening on TuneIn Radio. Johnny, go ahead with your question for Pat Flynn.
Good evening, Pat. Good evening, Cy. I talked to you before, Cy. How are you?
Very well, Johnny. I'm glad you're back. Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to let Pat know that I believe in God because I'm born with a hole in my heart. I've had two open heart surgeries, and one of my grandfathers was a Jesuit Donne back in the 17th century, I found out.
So, wait, who was back in the 17th century, Johnny? Say that again.
One of my grandfathers, Guillaume Couture, was a
Jesuit. Oh, I remember. I remember we talked about that. So wait, tell me what. Give me this, and then I'll get Pat to comment on it. You connect the hole in your heart with your belief in God. Most people would maybe go the other, or maybe not most people, but some people might go the other way. So why is the hole in your heart related to your belief?
I believe that God has put people to help me through my life.
Ah,
I've had I was baptized Catholic right before my first surgery, and I was 8 months old, and I've had two heart surgeries.
Okay.
And a lot of my family's now gone with God, but I believe that they're still helping me through God, and the people who are currently helping me.
What a beautiful witness, Johnny. Pat, yeah. I just want to see if Pat has a comment on that, or we'll just leave.
Yeah, I certainly do. Well, God bless you. And you know, as much as I talk about arguments for the deism of God, I actually don't think you need arguments to be justified in believing in God. And I think there's actually a lot of reasons why you don't necessarily need arguments to be justified in believing in God. So I think it's a beautiful testimony. I think it actually relates. Si, you kind of brought up, you hinted at the problem of evil there. Some people would, you know, maybe look at this condition and say, how is that compatible with an all good, we're all loving God? And there's a lot that could be said about the problem of evil, and maybe we could do a whole episode on it. Maybe we have. I forget, Si. We've had a lot of conversations before. But Johnny, you mentioned something beautiful that, you know, and I think this is a deeply Christian insight, that our suffering, while it is conducive for us, if we respond to it appropriately, right, it might not be just for us, right? Our suffering can be for the good of other people as well. And you know, God is such a wonderful governor and creator that he can ensure that your suffering, while it sets the conditions for some greater good in your own life. And fundamentally, God's concerned about curing a spiritual cancer, right? That's what God's concerned about in us, right? He can also make it the case that your suffering provides the conditions for greater goods in other people's lives as well. Expressions of empathy, compassion, caring, mercy, forgiveness, all those sorts of things. So I just wanted to highlight, that's, I think, an aspect of the problem of evil, where yes, we definitely want to say that God will permit suffering to us insofar as it sets the conditions for some greater justifiable good. But it doesn't have to be just for us either. And I think that's important to keep in mind.
Johnny, I got one more caller I want to get on, so I got to let you go. But I'm very grateful for the call. And if you would like a copy of Jimmy Akin's book, The Words of Eternal Life, I'd like to send it to you. I don't know if we've ever sent it to you, but hang on the line and Edgar will get you if you'd like a copy of that book. I do want to get to John in Massachusetts because he's been waiting a long time. So I hope you'll forgive me, Johnny. John, go ahead with your question. If you can be kind of quick, then Pat can get you an answer.
Good evening. Hi,
John.
I'm out here walking my dog here in this cold New England weather, which I can't help but find sort of pertinent to the concept I wanted to ask you about, which is the idea that we are born seeking God, and, you know, and that's just sort of a human trait, I guess, from what I understand. And I was just sort of, it's relatively new to me. I was just hoping you might be able to talk more on that.
What do you make of that, Pat?
Yeah, what do I make of that? Well, I think it's a good observation. It seems to have support from the various relevant fields of psychology that that belief in God and sort of agency in the world, greater agency, is sort of a belief that's sort of naturally occasioned in us. It's not something that we necessarily need to be taught. And, you know, as our sort of consciousness gels and we start operating in the world, it just seems to be a sort of natural belief in teleology, directedness, agency, God. I think that finds some pretty good support, again, in the relevant areas of psychology, but also links back to this. Actually, we could probably tie a couple of things together here. Si, I mentioned Alvin Plantinga, and he's one of the guys who says you don't really need arguments to be justified for belief in God. Now, why is that, right? Well, he thinks that belief in God is something like belief in other minds. Whereas I believe, Si, that you're a minded individual like me. You have first-person phenomenal experiences. You're not just like some clever android or something like that. And Plantinga thinks this is a properly basic belief. It's not something that we reason up to. It's a starting point for us. We're totally well justified in holding that belief entirely apart from arguments. It's a belief that's just sort of occasioned in us, right, if you will. Anything's belief in God is like that. It's one of these sort of basic beliefs that again, is just sort of naturally occasioned in us. And he's got a list of these. But anyways, he thinks if God exists, right, yeah, and he put that belief in us, and we're reliable in our kind of belief formation generally, and that's one of those beliefs, then we're justified in believing it and totally apart from argument. And it seems like from psychological research that there's some support for that position.
John, any man who'll be out walking his dog in the cold New England weather deserves a free book. So if you'd like a copy of Jimmy's book, Words of Eternal Life, hang on the line and we'll send it, one to you as well. I'm sorry for those we did not get to, but Father Matthew Spencer's coming up next, and we'll do Ask a Priest the next hour. Check out philosophyforthepeople.com. If you like what Pat Flynn does, you can get a lot more of it there. Pat Flynn, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Cy, very much.
You can let the children run free again now.
I'll let them out of their cages.
Run back with Father Matthew Spencer on Catholic Answers Live.